We study history not to know the future, but to widen our horizons, to understand that our present situation is neither natural nor inevitable, and that we consequently have many more possibilities before us than we imagine. Yuval Noah Harari, writing in the book Sapiens. Welcome to The Green Urbanist, a podcast for urbanists fighting climate change. I'm Ross. Hello, hello, and welcome back to another episode of The Green Urbanist, the podcast for urbanists fighting climate change. Today's episode is a very special one for me. It's a solo episode, it's just going to be me. And it's basically on a topic that's something I've been thinking about for years and years and years. And I'm finally getting a chance to sort of put it in, just put it down somewhere and put these thoughts and these ideas down in a podcast for other people to listen to and hopefully find interesting. Before I get into the main topic, just say hello to any new listeners. I know the listenership has been sort of steadily growing over the months. Thank you all to everyone who's, you know, reaches out to me and says hello and tells me, you know, how they've been getting use out of the podcast. I need some help trying to solve a mystery. The mystery is, back in December, I released an episode called The Problem with Net Zero Carbon, which was pretty popular episode. It got sort of a normal amount of views, a normal amount of listens that I'd expect. And then 1 week in January, 600 people from Canada listened to it, seemingly randomly. I presume it must have gotten shared by someone in Canada somehow to get that many of views just like a couple of weeks after it was released for seemingly no reason. If you're one of these Canadians listening and somebody recommended the podcast to you and you listened to that episode, please let me know why that was. I certainly didn't get tagged on any social media from anyone, you know, prominent Canadian or anything. So I'm just really curious as to where this anomaly has come from. But yeah, you're very welcome if you're joining me from Canada. Great to have you here. So I want to talk about something that I think most urbanists never consider, but which I believe is incredibly important. And in fact, it might be a fundamental consideration for creating the kind of livable places that will sustain us into the future. This topic is human evolution, how we lived in our prehistory, and hunter-gatherer ways of life. If I can bundle all those into one topic, even though they're all actually quite different things, but I'm sort of thinking of those various connected topics together in this episode. So why would urbanists be interested in this? Well, the question of how our ancestors lived before agriculture and civilization points us towards the conditions in which we as human animals thrive and in which we can live in closest harmony with nature. The hunter-gatherer way of life is the only way of life that has been proven to be environmentally and socially sustainable over hundreds of thousands of years. Jared Diamond, for instance, the polymath and author, wrote, "Hunter-gatherers practiced the most successful and longest-lasting lifestyle in human history." And that's why it should be of interest to anyone who wants to figure out how we can live on the planet sustainably, but also how we can live good lives and what that might mean for our environment, our built environment that we live in. I'm first going to lay out an argument for why the lives of hunter-gatherers, also referred to as foragers, is relevant to us. And then I'll get into the specifics of how this may influence our approach to planning, urban design and architecture. Now, as I've scripted this out, I realize that it's far, far too long for one episode. And so to avoid you having to listen to just me for like over an hour, I'm going to split this up into a couple of different episodes. Definitely two, maybe three. So you should see that this is part one. Part two will come out probably next week. And so on. So keep an eye out for that. So mostly in part one, this episode, I'm just going to lay out the basic argument, which is sort of what you need to know about hunter-gatherer lives, or at least what I've been able to glean from reading about them. And then my argument for why I think this is important for us as urban designers, planners, etc. And then in subsequent episodes, parts 2 and 3, probably, I will then talk about actually how to apply this thinking to specific urban design considerations. First, a caveat. I have a background in geography, planning, and urban design. I have no formal training or experience in anthropology, evolutionary psychology, biology, archaeology, or any related discipline. Everything I talk about in this episode is stuff that I have read in books, heard on podcasts, seen in presentations on the internet. It represents my superficial understanding as an amateur of what is a vast and fascinating topic. So take that as you may. I'll list some of my main sources now so I can avoid interrupting the flow of the podcast too much. But the entire list of sources in this episode is in the episode description. I definitely recommend checking these out to get a much deeper understanding of the topics that I'm talking about here. So here are 3 books in particular that I found really useful. One is what you heard a quote from at the beginning of this episode, which is Sapiens by Yuval Noah Harari, which provides an amazing overview of actually the entirety of human history, but including our hunter-gatherer ancestors. Second one is a book called Civilized to Death by Christopher Ryan, which provides a critique of modern civilization, as the name suggests, and it sort of debunks the common narratives that our foraging past was nasty, brutish, and short. And I'll talk a bit about that as well. And finally, one that should be of real interest to urbanists, which is called Uncivilized Genes, that's G-E-N-E-S, by Gustav Meine. M-I-L-N-E is his last name. I think it's pronounced Mine. Which actually applies knowledge of prehistory directly to urban planning. And it covers a lot of ground, so it might actually be a good starting point for anyone who's new to this topic. Really, really interesting. And obviously then puts it into, you know, context for this audience. Now, there are 2 basic points that we need to agree on before we can move on to talk about what this, what sort of our understanding of prehistory means for how we design towns and cities. Firstly, that the hunter-gatherer lifestyle is what we have evolved for and are therefore optimized for, which, you know, makes it a consideration in design. And secondly, that in general, hunter-gatherers enjoyed an extremely high quality of life, which was sustained over hundreds of thousands of years and is therefore sustainable, clearly, and that we should seek to emulate that. The backdrop of this argument is something that I've mentioned a couple of times in the podcast, is really that modern life as we know it is not all that great in terms of our health, our mental well-being, and clearly, of course, our impact on the ecosystems around us and on planet Earth. Okay, on to point 1. Over the course of 2 million years, our ancestors evolved into what scientists call anatomically modern Homo sapiens about 300,000 years ago. Or at least that's the sort of the oldest remains of anatomically modern Homo sapiens that we found was about 300,000 years ago. This means that for the last 300,000 years, every human being has had the same basic biology, 2 thumbs, upright posture, a big brain, vocal cords, you know, the whole thing. We have not changed biologically in any significant way in the last 10,000 generations. And we spent the vast majority of that time living as hunter-gatherers or foragers embedded within ecosystems. In other words, the lifestyle of hunting and gathering is what we are optimized for. And so we should learn from this way of life in order to thrive in the modern world and in modern cities. So the key takeaway here is that history seems long, but the last 10,000 years of, you know, agriculture, city building, major world religions, democracy, capitalism, etc., are all very recent ways of living compared to our long, long history as hunter-gatherers. And this means to understand what the human animal needs from a habitat, whether that's the African savanna or a modern megacity, we need to understand our own prehistory. As Christopher Ryan writes in Civilized to Death, here are some things we can safely say about the origins of our own species. Almost all of our ancestors lived as foragers from millions of years ago until the advent of agriculture, roughly 10,000 years ago. Foragers living in different ecological circumstances around the world organize their lives in strikingly similar ways. Anthropologists have noted commonalities in how they handle parenting, distribute political power and wealth, resolve conflicts, view relations between the sexes, experience spirituality, and even how they understand and confront death. These commonalities exist among disparate societies, isolated from one another, because they arise from foraging itself. These behavioural and cognitive patterns persist because they work in the social world of foragers, whatever the physical environment. Finally, because these cognitive and behavioural patterns have been integral to the experience of our species for hundreds of thousands of years, they live on within us, having shaped our basic social and political disposition. End quote. Okay, point number two. The lives of hunter-gatherers are not nearly as bad as we have been led to believe, and in fact, they likely enjoy a higher quality of life, better health, and stronger social ties than most people in modern urbanized societies. I'm using present tense here because there are still hunter-gatherers in the world today, and a lot of what I'm talking about is a mixture of evidence from anthropologists in, say, the 19th century, going and spending time with hunter-gatherer bands that have now sadly been lost. Also more contemporary accounts of people spending time with hunter-gatherer groups who still exist in places like Africa and in the Amazon jungle, but also evidence that we have from archaeology, from the remains of people from this time, and we can infer things from how they live. So the tenses I'm using throughout this will get a bit confusing because sometimes I'm talking about, 100,000 years ago. Sometimes I'm talking about accounts from actually hunter-gatherers that exist now. But really the lessons learned are the same. So you may be thinking, these sort of primitive people, hunter-gatherers, only lived to be 30 years old, 35 years old, as is commonly quoted. And that short lifetime was a constant fight for survival against a cruel natural world. This is unfortunately still a common narrative, but it actually dates back to a 17th century philosopher who had no contact with these so-called primitive peoples. Thomas Hobbes is the man who famously proclaimed that life before the state was solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. Far from a reliable scientific source, this infamous description is more like propaganda. It says far more about the dominant paradigm of 17th century high society in Europe than it does about the indigenous foragers who still occupied large parts of the world at this time. Christopher Ryan spends much of his book debunking the standard narrative around prehistory and what he calls the narrative of perpetual progress, which says that modern society is the best time to be alive and things will continually get better. Writing about the commonalities that anthropologists have found among foragers, Ryan writes, "The characteristics consistently found in foraging societies are egalitarianism, mobility, and gratitude. Anthropologists refer to foragers as fiercely egalitarian, meaning that an individual's autonomy is non-negotiable. Leadership cannot be imposed and tends to be informal and non-coercive, growing out of respect and consensus. Individuals can and do attempt to persuade one another, but they have little or no leverage to impose their wishes. Reciprocity is expected, and the hoarding of food or selfishness of any kind is not tolerated. Children are respected as autonomous individuals and cared for by unrelated adults as well as their biological parents." On mobility, he writes, "Base camps shift and reconfigure frequently, often seasonally, as individuals and small groups move through the environment in search of food. This mobility is an important factor in social organization in that people can easily walk away from uncomfortable situations. Because bands join and split apart frequently, moving to a neighboring band is always an option to avoid brewing conflict or just for a change of social scenery." And thirdly, on gratitude, "Foragers tend to see themselves as the fortunate recipients of a generous environment and benevolent spirit world. The land is the source of all they need. This view is roughly the opposite of the narrative of perpetual progress, with its depiction of the natural world as hostile, dangerous, and begrudging. End quote. It's worth emphasizing the point here that, according to anthropologists, many of the aspects of modern, democratic, left-leaning societies that we have fought hard for and think of as being the pinnacle of progress, like equality, social mobility, freedom to make our own decisions, collaboration over competition, these are things that hunter-gatherer groups take for granted. They're just a standard part of being human. Somewhere over the course of civilization, we lost these things, and many people in the world have still not realized them once again. So why are they such a consistent feature of hunter-gatherer societies? It's actually an evolutionary advantage. Consider that human beings are not particularly ferocious predators. A single Homo sapien would be easy prey for a lion and would be hard-pushed to chase down a gazelle by itself. And so there is strength in numbers. We evolved as a social species who sticks together and collaborates for safety and the sharing of tasks and resources. When your very survival depends on you getting along with 50 to 150 other people, the only way to do this is through egalitarianism, kindness, generosity, and fairness. These are the traits for which we are evolved. It paints a much brighter picture of human nature compared to people like Richard Dawkins, who describe us as inherently selfish and violent. Quoting again from the book Civilized to Death, linguist Daniel Everett spent over 20 years living with the Piraha, a group of foragers in the upper Amazon. In Don't Sleep, There Are Snakes, his memoir of these years, Everett writes, "The Piraha laugh about everything. They laugh at their own misfortune. When someone's hut blows over in a rainstorm, the occupants laugh more loudly than anyone. They laugh when they catch a lot of fish. They laugh when they catch no fish. They laugh when they're full and they laugh when they're hungry." The laughter of the Piraha suggests an easy harmony with the world that they inhabit, which is the world their minds and bodies expect because it is essentially the same environment that created them. I don't mean this in a metaphorical sense, I mean this literally. The people Everett describes are at home in the Amazon jungle in the same way a cactus is a home in the desert. Their lives aren't easy, but the difficulties and dangers they face are familiar because they were faced by many previous generations. You and I, however, live in a world no other human generation has ever known. End quote. So what does a day in the life of a forager look like? Surely it's a lot of work to catch and gather all your own food, build shelter, and keep predators at bay. Actually, no, not really. Quoting again from the same book by Christopher Ryan, Peter Gray has identified four main reasons to conclude that the daily lives necessary to a forager's survival are more accurately seen as play than as work. 1. It is varied and requires skill and intelligence, leading to the satisfaction of being good at something that requires our full attention. The forager's abilities include physical skills honed by years of practice, as well as the capacity to remember, use, add to, and modify an enormous store of culturally shared verbal knowledge. 2. There is not too much of it. Anthropologists in various parts of the world have determined that foragers rarely work more than a few hours per day. 3. It is done in a group of friends. In most ecological contexts, hunting parties consist of at least a few men, and women almost always hunt and gather in groups. Anthropologist Alf Wannenberg described gathering expeditions with the Kung San as jolly events, often having something of the atmosphere of a picnic outing with children. And 4, it is, for any given person at any given time, optional. This is the most important aspect determining the playfulness of the hunter-gatherer existence, as it is the sense of choice that ultimately determines whether something is work or play. Crucially, foragers have found a way to get things done while maximizing every participant's sense of being free to join or not. End quote. It's worth hammering home the fact that the activities the hunter-gatherers must do to survive are the kind of things that people nowadays do for enjoyment, to relieve stress, and as hobbies. Things like hunting, fishing, going on long walks or hikes with friends, tending to plants and vegetables, and building things with their hands, which must surely account for our contemporary obsession with DIY. However, whatever way you cut it, our ancestors spent most of their time outdoors, in pristine natural environments, engaging in rewarding physical activity with people they know and love. Evening time would have involved eating the freshest, most organic food possible, sitting around fires telling stories, playing music and dancing. If that doesn't sound like the good life, I don't know what is. However, I don't want to romanticize this period of history. It's not without its brutality. Human beings are, of course, both predators and prey. In truly wild environments, we are at risk of attack from wolves, bears, big cats, or whatever their equivalent was hundreds of thousands of years ago, as well as hunting accidents. Without modern medicine, a broken bone or a deep wound is often fatal. But even considering these risks, we need to ensure we're not just projecting our own fears onto our ancestors. Yes, if you and me went into the woods and tried to survive using our own intuition and skill, we'd probably be dead by next Tuesday. But hunter-gatherers, having spent their whole life in one environment and tutored by a community of highly knowledgeable and capable people, their tribe, know how to handle themselves. I remember reading a book called Keepers of the Story by Micah Springer, which is a memoir of the author, an American who travels across Africa. She ends up spending time with a traditional tribe where she gets an insight into their life and deep connection with the land. In one anecdote, she is accompanying a group of men on a hunt. On the way back to the camp, some of the hunters sense that they're being followed. They form a circle around the author to protect her and keep watch on all sides. Eventually, some rustling leaves gives away the pursuer. There's a lion crouching behind a nearby bush, waiting for its moment to pounce. Without hesitation, one of the men lunges, swinging his club, and whacks the lion on the nose, which turns and runs off into the savannah dusk. They all cheer and walk back to camp in good spirits. After reading that account, I sort of feel like it wasn't even the first time this guy had given a vicious predator a smack on the nose. Now, it's natural that primordial fears like predation, snakes, spiders, and heights are present in our mind. It's an evolutionary advantage to be wary of them. But consider the fact that in the modern world, there's a whole realm of ways to be debilitated and killed that never existed prior to agriculture or the Industrial Revolution. Air pollution is linked to the deaths of 10 million people a year. Traffic collisions kill 1.35 million people annually and cause 50 million injuries. In fact, the top three causes of death annually, heart disease, stroke, and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, are all dubbed diseases of civilization because they arose after we settled in cities and abandoned the hunter-gatherer lifestyle. As Vibar Cregan Reed writes on theconversation.com, the irony is that many advances in modern medicine are firefighting those very problems that modern life itself has created. The final point I want to tackle in this part of the discussion is the issue of life expectancy. There is an ongoing misconception that most hunter-gatherers did not see past their 35th birthday. This is in fact a miscommunication of data. When studied, the average life expectancy of sampled forager populations was indeed about 35 years. However, it was very common for people to live into their 70s. The reason for the very low average life expectancy is actually quite tragic. It's because hunter-gatherer groups have high levels of infant mortality, which means it's relatively common that newborns don't survive into adulthood. The hard stats are that infant mortality is 20 to 40% amongst hunter-gatherers, compared to just 1% in the UK and USA today. However, if a hunter-gatherer does survive into adulthood, they have a very good chance of living into their old age. Here is somewhere we can agree that modern society has huge benefits. This is one of the great opportunities we have now, in an era where we have so much control over our environment. We can learn from the lessons of the past while buffering it with modern innovations to get the best of both worlds. So, what does this mean for cities? That's the background. That's a very quick crash course in the lives of hunter-gatherers. And why I believe we should be interested in it. It's about time we move on to the meat of the argument. What am I actually proposing here? Should we abandon cities and go back to living as foragers? Well, that's not really an option. As Christopher Ryan writes in his unique way, human population levels long ago surpassed the carrying capacity of hunter-gatherer ways that require population densities lower than one person per square mile in most ecosystems. In any case, we're no longer the undomesticated beings our prehistoric ancestors were. we've lost too much of the knowledge and physical conditioning necessary to live comfortably under the stars. If our ancestors were wolves or coyotes, most of us are closer to pugs or poodles. Instead, he puts forward the idea that we are now the only species that actively constructs our own environment, a kind of human zoo. It's not our natural environment, but we have a choice, just as zoologists do, to design it in a way that mimics our natural habitat as best we can. So what does that look like? Well, you're going to have to wait until the next part of this series, because I've been talking long enough for now. In the next one or two episodes, depending on how long it goes on for, I'm going to talk about how what we know about hunter-gatherers could influence our urban design, and particularly how we arrange housing and how we could create small communities within cities that would mimic a kind of hunter-gatherer band. I also want to talk about biophilia, or in another way, how being embedded within nature is our natural habitat, and again how we might recreate that within an urban environment. And finally, I want to talk about movement and how the way we move our bodies and move through the environment is so important for our health and also for sustainability, and how we might be able to, in quite a radical way, recreate more of our natural movement patterns within urban environments. So please tune in next time. Look, to get reminded that this, when this episode comes out, make sure to subscribe to the podcast. You can also follow me on social media. I'm on LinkedIn as Ross O'Kelly, my name. Also, Green Urbanist Pod podcast is on LinkedIn. I'm on Twitter, Green Urban Pod, and I'm on Instagram, Green Urbanist Pod. So follow me in one of those ways and you'll get an indication of when the next episode is out. And yeah, for now, thanks for listening and see you next time.